extra help from us?
I don't think so, because my amendment...
Welcome, everyone. It's April 6, 2017. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're going to start with a few quick work sessions. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2210 for the purpose of carrying it over to Tuesday, April 11th at 8 a.m. We're waiting for paperwork. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2210. Okay. I'm also going to open a work session on House Bill 2221. For the purpose of carrying it over to Tuesday, April 11th at 8 a.m., we are waiting for paperwork. Close the work session on 2221. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2170 for the purpose of holding it over to Tuesday, April 11th at 8 a.m. And Representative Stark, would you catch us up on this so we don't have too much to do next week when we're cramming?
Thank you, and appreciate your patience with this. This is the also known as the Ombudsman Bill. To jog your memory, a couple things we're trying to do is we want to pull the foster child ombudsman out from under DHS and also create a foster parent ombudsman. The intention is to create a Office of Oregon Ombudsman. We passed out last time when I was on my deathbed, and some testified on my behalf this beautiful little chart of how we envisioned this looking. One of the issues that came up after that hearing was the sharing of information with, if we pulled the foster child ombudsman out from under DHS, what are the laws that allow them to have access to the child's information? And so, fortunately, recently we had the opportunity to get DHS, DOJ, Elsie, everybody together in a room to come up with a language that we think accomplishes that. We've submitted that language, and we are waiting for that amendment to come back in order to have everyone do one last proof of that, make sure it says what we think it's going to say, and then we should be ready to go. We're expecting, without that amendment, we don't know the exact fiscal yet, but we're expecting it to be somewhere in the $750,000 range, and we'll have to duke that out once it gets to Ways and Means. So
any questions for Representative Stark? All right, then we are going to hold over House Bill 2170 to Tuesday, April 11th at 8 a.m. Close the work session on that. Open a work session on House Bill 2500 for the purpose of trying to pass this one, actually.
Ready
Got
to go.
Got the paperwork. Cassie, can you remind us what the bill is, please?
Yep. House Bill 2500 directs Department of Human Services to develop and implement caseworker training and continuing education, informing and instructing on juvenile dependency proceedings. The bill requires instruction and materials on engaging in legal practices and parameters from juvenile dependency judges and attorneys, and requires continuing education for caseworkers every 2 years. We heard this bill on February 9th and February 16th. We have a -3 amendment. The -3 amendment directs DHS to consult with the Department of Justice to develop and implement training and continuing education for DHS caseworkers. The amendment changes the requirement for training to occur every 4 years and changes instruction from judges to Department of Justice. The amendment also removes the Attorney General from providing instruction and materials. The fiscal is minimal to DHS and DOJ, and the revenue has no impact, and there is a sub-referral to Ways and Means.
Before you start, Representative Stark, would you like to...
Sure. A couple comments.
Us.
Yeah, so DHS is in court quite frequently, and caseworkers are not attorneys. However, we have a habit of putting them in a situation where they can easily get themselves into trouble by unlawfully attempting to practice law. And we want to make sure that they have the best training possible to know what they should and should not do in those circumstances. When we originally drafted this bill, we talked about DHS basically contracting out for these services. DOJ, kudos to them, they saw this and said, wait a minute, we're the ones that should be doing that training, and we won't charge you to do that training. Loved that. And then the other change here, as far as the 2 to 4, if we kept the 2-year timeline, then that was going to somewhat rush caseworkers into training and cause them to go outside of a normal training routine and therefore hence a fiscal. So we bounced it out to 4 to make sure there's ample time for them to go through their normal training cycle and begin incorporating that into it, and therefore removes the fiscal.
And this, as a reminder, came originally from former Representative Wayne Krieger, who had a lot of interaction with the foster care system. It's good to see him still engaged. Okay, so Vice Chair?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 27, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 27, 2017. Is there any discussion?
I do, ma'am.
Yes.
Actually, I'm going to hold off for the main,
actual bill.
The bill.
Okay. So is there any objection to the -3? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2500, let's do it that way, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2500 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before we move on there, didn't we remove the fiscal, so does it still go to Ways and Means?
Well, it's kind of minimal, doesn't it?
Well, that's a good question. Why don't you type? And Representative Noble, you wanted to...
Thank you. I'm going to vote yes, but my concern remains with us having to be so prescriptive with training when I think this should actually be originated from a department comprehensive training plan to ensure that they're trained. And I understand the fiscal impacts and the need to come before the legislature, but to be so prescriptive, I think, is indicative of some other issues that I wish the department would have taken care of.
Is Representative McLean here for the next bill? No. Why don't we stand at ease?
Just to find
out. Go get your coffee for a few minutes, because Representative McLean's supposed to come at 8:15 for his bill. And we'll get an answer on this one. And just stand at ease. Okay, reopening the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. I'm going to be closing the work session on House Bill 2500 until we get further notification that we can remove the referral to Ways and Means. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2741 and House Bill 2742.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike McLean. I represent District 55, which is Central and Southern Oregon. And a few years back, my district suffered a horrific wildfire out east of Chiloquin, Sprague River area that destroyed 17 homes. Many of these homes were single-wide mobile homes on smaller plots, and this was along an old subdivision, had problems with defensible space, but in the end, the fire blew so quick through there, it was a miracle no one was killed. But a lot of the folks in there were retired, they did not have insurance, and the community stepped forward and did a wonderful thing, caring for them. So Peter Courtney and I sponsored a bill together to create the Wildfire Damage Housing Relief Fund to provide the about $5,000 per household where they didn't have insurance. They were clearly low income, because one of the challenges that came out of that was in order to get permits to start over, you have to clear the ground, and you have to pay a contractor to come in. Many of these folks did not have $3,000-$4,000 it took to literally clear the site so they could rebuild start in the permit fees to begin to set a used mobile home there or to rebuild. So the idea was that I helped a lot of these folks as my constituents, and what happened was that we just didn't have anywhere for anyone to receive relief. There was private relief, and the folks in Klamath County were great, but it was clear that some folks It took them a long time to have private funds come in and assist. And so people who lose a home in a wildfire are not hard to find. We know who they are after it happens. And if you don't have insurance, or your insurance's premium is so high because of where you live, the deductible, the question becomes, how can we help people move quickly into rebuild phase or clear it? Because it's in the public's interest to get these spots cleared. And so why the amounts are low, many people ask, and because the goal of it was to help people to get the process started, which takes about $5,000, a little bit more. So we started the relief fund. The Department of Housing and Community Service put out promulgated rules. Then we had the devastating fire in Grant County. Multiple people who were affected by that fire applied, but nobody was issued a grant because of the way the rules were written. And so we keep scratching our head, but in the end, what we want the department to hear and what we're trying to be very clear out is get them the speed in which you issue $5,000 or $7,000 to these people is directly related to the speed in which a contractor comes in, clears these spots, and which is a safe thing to do, and then they're able to apply for permits, etc. So it's not been without hiccups, and I think the department understands that perhaps the rules they promulgated were too restrictive. So the goal of this is to make sure that the wildfire damage relief housing or housing relief account is issuing to folks who are at the federal poverty level, and to get it, which means these a lot of the folks we're trying to help are retired, and their Social Security income puts them in an applicable place. Number two, get the checks quickly out there so these guys can start. Number three, we need to have enough in there to do some good. I tried to get $500,000 in there before, and the chair of the Ways and Means from the House reduced it to $50,000. And I have two bills, one to send it to Ways and Means. And I ask you to send that bill, House Bill 2741, to Ways and Means, where I can continue. We have a new chair in the House. She's much nicer than the old chair. And so I'm working on her. And maybe we can get a little more in there and be ready to go. And then the second aspect is to House Bill 2742 is to raise the amount. I think the department has received the word to adjust the rules, so let's get this program doing. But it's to raise it from 5-7 per grant because of what we more know more about the two things: clear this pad, clear the spot, the fees to apply. Now, I understand, Madam Chair, you have an amendment. I think that's wise to say if you have insurance proceeds to do it, then you don't need a grant. I think that's true.
Or you would use that first, and then the remaining amount could come from the state.
Yes. Right. Yes, Madam Chair. Anyway, happy to answer any questions. That's how we got here. And but it's still important because when wildfire hits a rural, community, what we're talking about is are people who are not living in any town. They're in rural parts of Oregon, and there's usually three or four houses together or very similar. They're on a 5-acre or a 10-acre, and when the wildfire hits, it hits fast, and everyone loses everything. And so we want to be ready to be able to assist, and it's we just don't know when the next one will come, and we pray it will not be soon.
Any questions from the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question about the insurance aspect of it. This is my first, introduction to this. is potentially can we provide service if they have a deductible, maybe, because even coming up with that cash may be difficult, and some of these deductibles could be $1,000, $2,000. And so is there any room for addition of that to help support?
Well, I think that's what it would go toward. If they had insurance, then it would go toward their deductible, I would guess. So we want it to complement the insurance. As I recall from last time, I think that one of the reasons we don't want necessarily for people to think we don't need insurance, we'll just rely on the state. But this is the reason for this is because it's very hard to get insurance in these wildfire areas. And if they can get it, it's prohibitively expensive. And these are low-income people. So this is not meant to give them an out on their private insurance. We still want to encourage them to have private insurance, but we just want to help them. So that's what I remember from a couple of years ago.
Yes, Madam Chair, there is it's a high deductible. You'd be shocked at what I pay on my farm because of the distance just in Powell Butte from any fire station. And when you're talking about people who are living in very remote, you know, off the grid, a lot of them, and little clusters, they can't obtain insurance, or they do, it's very expensive and high deductible. And because insurance companies say, wow, one wildfire, you know, your house is gone because who can respond? And but in a lot of folks who go out there and live in the areas have always dreamed of having some acreage or living in the country, or they want to be out there because of the peace and beauty. And so, you know, they buy a small parcel, and they're usually fixed income. And that seems to be the ones, unfortunately, who are losing everything in wildfires. But in Grant County, obviously, it was some of that and both. But in the last, 4 years, we've had two wildfires that have started one place and moved in and just consumed homes. Mm-hmm. And the speed in which it happened is so fast that mm-hmm. they lose everything.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know Housing Community Services is in the room if anyone has any question or if they would like to make any statement. Otherwise, we will move this to – I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on both of them. I'm going to start with House Bill 2741. Tana?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2741 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2741 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion about this? All right. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Excused.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative
Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny.
Aye. The motion passes. Close the work session on House Bill 2741. Open the work session on House Bill 2742. And Tassie, can you just read the amendment? Well, go ahead and just read the amendment, I guess.
Okay.
I think Representative McLean already described the bill.
The -2 amendment for House Bill 2742 allows Housing and Community Services Department to reduce or refuse assistance from the wildfire damage housing relief account if the household has received insurance proceeds or other compensation for all or part of the loss of housing. We have the fiscal, and the fiscal requires further analysis, and the revenue has no impact. There is a sub-referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 4, 2017.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 4, 2017. Any discussion on those? Any objection? All right. Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2742 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2742 is amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion on the bill? All right. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch.
Excused.
Representative
Meek. Aye.
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 Representative
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Guyer?
Aye. Motion passes. Close the work session on House Bill 2742. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3063. Representative Olson, do you want to kick it off or should we just start with her?
Yeah, I think we just go ahead and allow Laura.
So can we please have John Rupp and Chris Bunoff in the meantime? Cassie, can you please read the bill? And I will say that Representative Olson and I are chief sponsors and have been in the past as well. So please read the summary.
House Bill 3063 establishes the Mental Health Housing Fund to develop community-based housing for individuals with mental illness and provide other housing-related services. The bill specifies the maximum allocation of funds towards certain construction and startup costs. The bill appropriates money to the Oregon Health Authority for implementation and requires OHA to seek and apply for additional funding. The bill also requires OHA to convene an advisory group to make recommendations for the Mental Health Housing Fund regarding allocation of money, housing proposals, and processing applications. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage and does have a sub-referral to Ways and Means.
Excuse me, Chair Kenny Guyer, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bonneff, the executive director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI. We are a grassroots organization that provides education, support, and advocacy services to families and individuals affected or living with mental health conditions. We're a grassroots organization. We have 15 chapters across the state, 1,500 members. We're membership governed. Annually, we serve about 8,000 Oregonians a year through our free programming. Here today to speak on House Bill 3063. Quick history. This legislation, this is, I think, the third time we're coming forward with this legislation. Back in 2012, we all recognized in our system that we lacked a lot of housing, and we use housing in the broadest sense of the term. It's not just this is where I'm living right now permanently. We look at housing consisting of licensed treatment housing in addition to our independent housing. Primarily it's because we spend long periods of time in treatment sometimes, and we consider that this is the place that we are living in that given time. So when we use that term, we are talking about everything from high-end secure residential treatment all the way to this is my permanent home, I have the key to my door, and this is where I live. In our system, we all recognize that we had log jams. We couldn't get people out of the Oregon State Hospital because we didn't have step-down treatment. We couldn't get people out of that step-down treatment because we didn't have independent housing. And we couldn't get people into the Oregon State Hospital who were sitting in hospital rooms and in emergency rooms. We had a log jam. So rather than kind of come running to the legislature saying money, 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 NAMI convened a number of stakeholders that included the future of the court, what were going to become coordinated care organizations, the people who provided services in housing, people who developed housing, the people who financed housing, to try to come up with a mechanism by which we can incentivize the development of housing, particularly for people living with serious mental illness, without coming to the legislature saying you need to pay 100% of the freight. What we came up with is the legislation you see before you, a mechanism by which we provided incentive funding. In the first round of funding, the idea was that the state would contribute a 20% incentive to build all these various types of housing. And the people developing that housing, we're going to have to find that 80% elsewhere. We were fairly convinced this process would work given the breadth of the stakeholders we had at the table running numbers. I mean, we tried to do our due diligence, and I believe we're successful. In 2013, out of the special session, the legislature allocated $5 million to this concept. We were able to execute this concept, not necessarily through this legislation, but through an MOU that we had with the Oregon Health Authority. That $5 million investment turned into about $24.5 million in total housing, somewhere around 100 individual housing units, plus 24 crisis respite beds, as an example of the type of licensed housing that we hope to fund. Based on that success in 2015, $20 million was allocated for this type of housing. Rather than through legislation, it was done through a budget note. The first round of funding from that, because it was done with bonding, there's a longer period of time by which you can actually execute that and award projects. First round of funding went out around August, September, October, November, so in the fall. There was $3.8 million in awards. That led to housing projects, or will lead to housing projects, with a market value of $22.7 million. We're talking about 148 housing units and additional 12 crisis respite beds. So we feel like through demonstrating that this concept works, that if you provide a particular incentive, that you will have providers and financiers and other partners coming to the table with other types of financing. And one of the surprises was there were actually people coming to table with conventional financing. So it wasn't other pockets of government funding. It was, I'm coming with my bank loan from my bank with a mortgage saying, you know, this project will pencil out. And in fact, public funding then is very much leveraged to the maximum. So we feel like this process worked. One of the difficulties is we don't have a structure. And so every time we relied on, the first time we relied on an MOU, and then we relied on a kind of vague budget note. And it's been difficult because of this, on this ad hoc basis, the partnerships that are necessary to bring projects to fruition and bring them to the table are much more complex and broader than what we're accustomed to. You have to have at the table people who can do affordable housing, who finance affordable housing, who provide mental health services, coordinated care organizations, counties. You have a bunch of people together who don't normally talk and collaborate. What this bill is intended to do is to put that structure in place, is that using our experience from 2013, using our experience from 2015, we have a current round of funding out now, so we expect to amend this bill based on the learning from our current round of funding that closes in later this month. To have a structure in place that we know we can interact with, the partners know is there, so that the one time a year we come out with an RFP, people know it exists and can interact and can prepare their partnerships well in advance of the legislature ever allocating funding. It also gives a structure that we hope has confidence in the legislature, that when you allocate money, you are able to deposit in this incentive fund following this structure, which leverages state spending. And that way you have confidence that this money will be spent wisely rather than relying on a more nebulous MOU or a budget note that kind of hints that you should follow this process but doesn't quite put that structure in place. Again, we expect if we're successful here in this committee in Ways and Means, we do expect to alter this based on many of the things we've learned in the previous two rounds of funding and the round of funding that is currently out right now. I will close, and my colleague here will be able to speak more to it. I think we all know how important housing is. I think if you look on OLIST, you can see how important it is to our membership. You put out one appeal and suddenly 20 people from around the state are writing in. This is a paramount issue to our organization because we live this every day. You cannot have recovery unless you have some stability in the place where you're at that given time. You can't get out of the treatment system if you're stuck in it because we don't have that placement for you, that step down or that independent housing. And you're at risk of actually losing independent housing if we can't get you through the system fluidly because we'll put you in an institution and you're stuck there for long periods of time because we have no alternatives to move you out. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. I am John Rupp, and I live here in Salem, and I'm an active member of NAMI Oregon. Back in 2008, I had a mental health breakdown, and I lost everything and ended up in jail for the first time in my life. I'm not going to dwell on that part of the story because I'm here to tell you about the positive success story that happened to me as a result of provided housing for me when I got out of jail and how it works. When I was in jail, I was in Marion County Jail here. I had, they knew that I had some mental health problems, and so I had three different psychiatrists work with me while I was in jail. They diagnosed me with mental illness. They worked with me on medications, and they provided medications I needed to get the symptoms relieved from that illness. When I came to my release day, it was kind of a horrible feeling because I was knew I was going to walk out that door, and I had nothing, and I had nowhere to go. When I walked out the door, one of the psychiatrists came up to me and said, "John, I have somewhere to take you." And he took me to PCC, which is Psychiatric Crisis Center down by the hospital. And through a special community program, they provided me 6 months of housing and wraparound services. And that same night, I had a roof over my head, and I had the food I needed. I had all the necessities I needed. And I can't explain the load that was lifted off me just to know that I had that and had that stability and that I'd be able to stay there and get my feet back on the ground and start a new direction in my life. PCC worked with me every day, and I also got services through Adult Behavioral Health at the Marion County Health Department, and they continued to help me adjust and fine-tune my medications to where I had relief from my symptoms so I could think about other things and start my new direction in life. Some of the services, like one of them, they took me around the Salem busing system and provided me a monthly bus pass so I could get everywhere I needed to go. And they continued to work with me in counseling. I'm happy to tell you today that in the last 8 years since then, I did get my feet back on the ground. And I'm a productive member of society once again, and I've been able to make amends and restore relationships that I had lost with my family and friends. And I'll tell you that those relationships today are the best they've ever been in my entire life. And there's many people across the state of Oregon that are in the position I was in 9 years ago. They have mental illness of some sort. They end up in jail, maybe the state hospital. When their release day comes up, they walk up to that door like I did, and many of them do not have somebody waiting there on the outside saying, "Hey, I've got somewhere to take you." And they have nothing, and they have nowhere to go. And my heart goes out to all of them, and
Thank you very much.
I ask for your support for HB 3063. Thank you.
Sounds like housing was a critical piece. Great. Do you want to ask a question about the fiscal?
So, I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, I'm looking at the fiscal on this thing here. I don't know if you had a chance to see it or not.
Yes.
And I guess I'm a little frustrated with it since the Chair and I are, chief co-sponsors on this bill. It's coming in from the Oregon Health Authority at $463,000 over the next 2 years and the following 2 years after that with two FTE. This has been in motion for the last 3 years. The way I've seen it and everything, I don't know how they landed with two FTE. I can maybe see a stretch for one. I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Sure. Chair Kennegeier, Representative Olson. Yeah, it comes as a shock because we've already been doing this.
Yeah.
So, and we've been doing it with existing FTE. The intent is not to add work. The intent is to actually give this structure some level of permanence so that, one, when funding is available, the legislature knows we're just going to deposit it here. And those of us on the other side of there who need to put together all these complex partnerships, rather than being told you have 1 month to do it, because an RFP is coming, surprise, surprise, we are constantly in motion putting those partnerships together in anticipation of the one time a year the RFP came out. I was rather surprised that FTE were attached to this because, and maybe in our amendment process we need to address that, but this should not add FTE. This should be something that we already do, which we do fund housing and we do RFPs.
You know, so Madam Chair, you and I, you know, we were both in that sub last session, and so I guess that's... I struggle with this myself.
Right. So last session, we were actually appropriating the money that was to be matched.
Right.
The last two sessions, in this case, you're not asking for money up front. You're asking for more, I think OHA interpreted it as more support so that they can be more active in the fundraising for sources outside the legislature. But, in fact, you have been doing that because that's the 80% that you're looking at that now we're looking at. Can they go beyond? Can they do 100%? If the state doesn't have the money to actually invest in the fund for the capital.
Sure. Yeah, Representative Kindergarten. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole intent is to give this some level of
structure,
right. So that,
right.
Because what we are running into, and ran into this with the most recent round of funding from the fall, is people are not accustomed to funding coming out like this with the type of partnerships that need to be in place. Affordable housing doesn't traditionally talk to coordinated care organizations. Well, to make this come to fruition, they have to. And to do that on an ad hoc basis is a barrier. We've addressed it. We had an MOU. We had a budget note. But in the feedback, we know that we will be more successful if we have a known structure that people can build partnerships around. So, and again, I'll just emphasize strongly, the intent, again, we've done this without FTE.
Mm-hmm.
The intent is to continue doing this without FTE.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So next we have Kevin McChesney and Cheryl Ramirez.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Residential Providers Association. We were one of the signers of that MOU after the special session in 2013, and we were very pleased with the outcome of that, the expenditure of that $5 million. Since then, with the $20 million in bond funding, we recognize that many of the providers that have previously participated in projects like that really didn't step up to the table. And we were curious as to why that was. As Chris mentioned, we spent some time getting feedback from providers. And what we found was that the time frames associated with the notices of financial availability through the Housing and Community Services Division didn't allow for sufficient flexibility or time to put together some of these complex partnerships that have to happen in order to fund these projects. So HB 3063 really addresses some of those issues by not restricting the process to going through Housing and Community Services Division, and also allowing for an avenue for input from that advisory committee to help make decisions around how that the length of time that people have to spend money, how they spend it, what components. And I think it also addresses the fact that providers were concerned that when we limited the amount to 20% of the project, that because of the current market, the real estate market, that wasn't sufficient to really entice providers to step up to the table. So the increase to the 35% we think is really important to getting provider participation. And as Chris also said, from a provider perspective, it's clear that for us to run a really efficient system, we really need to have this investment in housing, because it's probably one of the single biggest impediments for people moving through the treatment system and recovering.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Mental Health Programs, who help people with chronic behavioral health disorders find appropriate places to live, either when they're transitioning from the state hospital or jail or other restricted settings, or to prevent them from going to those restricted settings. As we know, housing is a basic need for all of us to live and thrive in our communities. And for people with chronic behavioral health disorders, supported housing is absolutely critical for their recovery and to remain in the community. So we're enthusiastically supportive of this bill and look forward to working closely with NAMI and other key stakeholders on the advisory group. And as you probably are aware, this is a top priority in the USDOJ agreement and in the subsequent Oregon performance plan to increase the numbers of people in supported housing and stable supported housing. So that's very important to us. We just have a couple of suggestions. One is to include the Housing and Community Services Division or Department as an advisory group member, since they do have some responsibility for housing for people with behavioral health disorders. We believe that it'd be important to ensure coordination between Housing and Community Services and Oregon Health Authority. And then secondly, we would urge expedited allocation of funding, maybe through vetting of potential subcontractors in the advisory group and or a shortened application process to get that money out there sooner rather than later. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, great. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3063 and suggest that people connect with Chris Bonoff on a possible amendment, and then also to talk with LFO about that fiscal. So, Cassie, could you work with Chris Bonoff and anyone that would like to join you in that conversation to see if we can get that fiscal down before we take a vote on this bill? Yep.
Madam Chair, just a quick question, just a clarification. So the bill says the Oregon Health Authority shall seek out and apply for grants, gifts, contributions. So if I'm understanding the moving parts of this, does the Oregon Health Authority currently have somebody doing that work now, or we're just coordinating with other outside?
Chris, would you like to come back up? Who is doing the work of coordinating the grant seeking right now?
Sure. Representative Meek. I imagine that will be a piece that will be in the amendment addressed there, because we what we've learned, the amendment's going to be about what we've learned, and what we learned is we don't need to seek out grants. What we need to do is have a structure in place by which, when the legislature appropriates funding, the structure's there to absorb that and get it out the door quickly. So there are several pieces in the current bill that we do expect to address an amendment.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. That's just my clarification, because I think we take it off of their authority and we get rid of those two FTEs.
Yep. Yep.
So, okay, thank you.
We'll work on that. Thank you so much. Okay, so I'm going to close the, public hearing on House Bill 3063 and open public hearing on House Bills 3273 and House Bill 3359.
Do the work session for 25.
Okay, I'm going to close those public hearings. I'm going to go back and open the work hearing on House Bill 2500, because we've got the change now. Took off the referral to Ways and Means. 2500 can go straight to the floor. Thank you for catching that, Rep. Stark.
Madam Chair, do we formally have to rescind the previous motion?
It is in the motion to rescind.
Thanks.
Okay, Vice Chair.
Well done, Vice Chair.
There you go.
Once a Vice Chair, always a Vice Chair over there.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2500 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Vice Chair Sanchez moves House Bill 2500 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch.
Excused.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Nearman.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative
Caliso.
Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye.
Chair Kenny Geyer.
Aye. The motion passes. Carrier, Representative Stark.
Please.
Okay. That's great. I close the work session on House Bill 2500 and open the public hearing on House Bills 3273 and 3359. And Vice Chair Olson, can you take my place for?
Absolutely.
Cassie, please read the bill and I'll join my.
House Bill 3273 modifies requirements relating to evacuation of residents of adult foster homes. The bill directs Department of Human Services to adopt rules and issue license as a conversion facility to long-term care facility, converting to residential care facility. The bill modifies the definition of residential care facility and directs DHS to adopt rules governing the use of electronic monitoring devices by resident in the facility. House Bill 3359 establishes the Dementia Community Assistance Program and requires DHS to administer and adopt rules for the program. The bill also establishes the Residential Care Quality Measurement Program and requires DHS to administer and adopt rules for that program. The bill directs DHS to establish evidence-informed framework for assessing compliance with requirements and notifying residential care facilities of the framework, and directs DHS to utilize technology-based staffing tools to evaluate levels and types of care needed. The bill requires direct care staff in residential care facilities and adult foster homes to complete dementia care training prior to providing care, and directs the Oregon Medical Board to encourage physicians with specialties in primary care or geriatrics to obtain continuing education regarding the early detection of Alzheimer's disease. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, well, good morning, and whoever would like to start first.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. Colleagues, you're going to see in front of you a couple of bills here that's going to address something that we probably don't really want to talk much about, and that is abuse of the elderly people in our society. I know each and every one of us here have parents that eventually we may end up in one of these facilities, so therefore we must take some steps to ensure that they would be fine. You're going to hear some testimony today from some people that have had some very serious problems with the care facilities, and they're really heart-wrenching problems that goes on in some of these facilities. I know my mother right now has dementia. She's in a lockdown community and cannot get out because she likes to roam and goes, you know, just wherever she wants to go. And so therefore she's completely vulnerable to anything that happens in that facility. So that's, and luckily for us, we have her in a very good facility and we check on her pretty regularly. My nephew does, but that isn't always the case. So we need to make sure that we have a adequate facility and one that's regulated to the point of where, and I don't believe in over-regulation. Don't misunderstand me. But I do know that when there are problems, we need to make sure that there's building blocks in place to prevent those from the future, because some of the things you're going to hear here, you're just going to shake your head. Trust me.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kati McEwen. I represent House District 9, Coos Beatty, Yahats, and I'm delighted to be here today. In the spring of 2015, I learned the story of Dot Wright. Dot was a resident of a local memory care facility in Coos Bay. Dot and her daughter Kathy and her son-in-law Tom are constituents of mine. And Kathy and Tom are medical professionals and visited Dot on an almost daily basis. And as time went on, they were recognizing that there were some lapses in care in the facility in which she resided. And they started emailing me about this, and it created concern on my behalf for my constituents. As time went on, a story came out on the front page of my local newspaper about Baycrest Memory Care, who was under sanction from the Department of Human Services for violations. And it was a grave situation. And because of the good work of Mr. and Mrs. Blastic, I became interested, concerned, and called DHS, and this quest began. So I attribute this to the Blastic family. Adults in dementia with dementia and Alzheimer's are most vulnerable, and I'm very concerned that if they don't have family members like Kathy and Tom, who's going to watch out for them? That falls to us. Colleagues, I want to be really clear. Most of the facilities in our state are run by responsible and caring people. They're respectable businesses that do a very good job, and they provide good care. I have a 96-year-old father who lives in an assisted living facility and has dementia. He's doing quite well. He gets good care. He has his three daughters who are very careful to make sure that everything is going very well. He has three sons-in-law who check in on him, and he's doing quite well. But that's not the case with everyone, as Representative Esquivel alluded to. And I tell you that not to exacerbate the personal aspect of this legislation, but to illustrate how many people this affects. At some point, it's going to affect all of us, whether it's a parent of yours. We are all aging. The population is growing, and this is very broad-based in its effect. What happened at Baycrest Memory Care is not acceptable. For 11 months, they were out of compliance where Dot was living. They had issues of medication management, sanitation and hygiene, failure to report incidents, staff not meeting training requirements, and the list went on and on and on. It took 11 months for DHS to be able to bring in a new management company. Those people lived into those situations for a very, very long time, and it created great concern on my part. And the correspondence that Mr. Blastic kept up just kept us informed as to what was happening, and that opened this door to this legislation today. Three facilities in my community have been in this situation. We have a brand new facility that opened within the last couple of weeks, 3 weeks down in my community, and they are already restricted. They've already had restrictions imposed on them for violations that have occurred. That's not okay. The Office of Economic Analysis and the Department of Administrative Services projected in the next 20 years there will be a 168% increase in the population that is 65 and over in this state. We, a lot of us, will be contributing to that number. The legislation is not only necessary to correct defects in how we care for our most vulnerable citizens today, the people that we are responsible to be caring for, but we need to give DHS the tools that they need to bring community-based care facilities into compliance for those bad actors that are emerging, but also, as our aging population increases, to prepare for the wave that is going to hit the shore as this aging population needs these very important services. In 2016, I brought House Bill 4083, which would have created a task force to study these issues. Unfortunately, that legislation failed. However, it did result in a dedicated and very talented group of stakeholders and professionals who formed a work group and have continued to fight to move this ball down the field. And on behalf of everyone that has participated over the last 18 months or so with this work, my thanks go out, because it's on behalf of their work and our elders that we're here today. I must thank Chair Kenny Geyer for taking up this charge after a hearing that was in her committee a year or so ago, for her guidance and her passion in helping spearhead this effort. I also want to thank Taylor Smiley Wolf from the Speaker's Office and Debbie Koreski from the Governor's Office, who have stood beside us as we have continued to work on this very important issue. I think it speaks volumes also to the gravity of these pieces of legislation that after over a year of significant policy discussions that both the Oregon Healthcare Association, and I want to give my hearty thanks to Jim Carlson and Phil Bentley for working through this with us over a very long period of time, and the staff at DHS who have remained at the table together in search of solutions to these problems that we have identified. This isn't perfect, but it's an important step forward. We are joined today by DHS staff. Ashley Carson Cottingham has led her staff through this, and I want to give a shout out to her for the work that they have done in dedicating a lot of time to this effort. The Ombudsman's Office is here to speak to you today. The Alzheimer's Association, we have a bicameral bipartisan group of legislators who are very interested in this work. And I want to also thank all the others who have demonstrated their desire to assist us in making sure that our elders are well cared for. It demonstrates the breadth of those efforts and the support of these policies by, I think, the people that you will find testifying today. I want to thank our constituents. I believe Representative Esquivel and I have constituents here who will speak briefly to you about the concerns that they have. And I think it's very important that they be a participant here because this is where this all started. And I think it will help you clearly understand what a pressing matter this is. I'm proud that we're all here today together presenting House Bill 3359 and House Bill 3273 for your consideration. And now I'm happy to turn this over to your illustrious chair. And then behind us, the certified smart people, the experts in the field, who will walk you through what is actually happening in this legislation. So thank you so much for your consideration today.
Thank you, Vice Chairs Olson, Sanchez, and my fellow members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I'm really up here mostly symbolically to support my colleagues who have really taken this issue on wholeheartedly. Two others of you on this committee sat through the testimony that Mr. and Mrs. Blastic provided last year, and it was really heart-wrenching, and I want to thank them for coming. I think Mr. Blastic's going to give a much shorter version of that this time around, because they helped put this issue on the radar for us, and Representative McEwen really just went running with it and has been there every step of the way through the task force that, even though it wasn't officially sanctioned and got no official support, we went ahead anyway, informal work group, I guess, thanks to all the participants. The OCA, the Oregon Healthcare Association, put together as a result a Purple Ribbon Commission, which expanded the participation further into other people with expertise and consumers and et cetera. So really the ball just continued rolling with more and more people getting very involved. And I just really, really want to thank all the people. I do think it's important to highlight what the issues are, but I want to make sure that we move in this hearing from the issues to the problem solving, because there's been, because of people bringing this to light for us, there's been enormous amount of problem solving. And I think the 3359, which was the Purple Ribbon Commission bill that combined a lot of the ideas that came out of that commission, as well as other ideas that have been out there, really brought that together. And this is a really big omnibus bill on quality, and I know that Phil Bentley and Ashley Carson Cottingham will walk you through that later, so I won't go into details, but it's very, very proud of the work that everyone has done on this. And Representative Esquivel, thank you. This is the second time you've come here on the issue of making sure that we have quality care for our senior citizens. The first one was around the food issue, making sure food handling was done properly. So I want to thank you also for highlighting this issue on behalf of your constituent as well.
Maybe it's because I'm becoming a senior.
So we're all getting closer to it.
Closer every day.
And the other bill, I just want to just say for the committee, we've been working very, very hard on amendments, and they're not in OLIS yet. So this is one of the things that we'll vote on at the very end. We've worked quarterly and then monthly, and then once the session started, weekly on these. And so 3359 is the big omnibus policy quality bill, really gold standard, and we hope to be really leading the entire nation in the quality of care. So I'm very excited that we've set the bar very, very high. And on 3273, that will be the bill that will have fees and fines. So you can ignore, don't even read what's in the bill. There will be a total gut and stuff on both of these with the Dash 1 amendment. We're trying to do all of the work and revisions and revisions and revisions without having 18 amendments, but actually it's almost like 18 amendments that will come out in one toward the end of this committee. So ignore the base bills and just go for the amendments when those are online. And I just want to, again, thank everyone. It's been an enormous amount of effort with very goodwill on all sides, and I look forward to hearing from everyone today. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So for our next group, folks, if James Beard from Jackson, Larry Runyon from Jackson, and also Thomas Blasty.
Thanks.
Yep. Please.
And we know we have a lot of people on this, so we're going to limit everyone to 5 minutes each. So Mr. Blastic and Mr. Beard, come on up. Go ahead and you can start.
Good morning, everybody. I'm James Beard. I'm a mortgage banker of 32 years, and I live in Medford for the last 20. My mom and dad, Julie Beard and Barry Beard. My mom, Julie Beard, was a radiologist and a dedicated mother. Barry Beard retired from the phone company. He was a veteran. They didn't have a lot of money, but they always paid their own way and pulled together a little extra money to have a nice care policy at the end of their life so they could live comfortably. In December 2012, they entered into a memory care facility called Farmington Square in Medford at over about $11,000 a month in private care. What they didn't know is what going into that home would cause a faster and painful death to them. Doctor orders requested their removal from the facility on March 13th of 2013, and adult services were notified on March 8th of 2013 and substantiated a number of claims on them. They received severe abuse and neglect. Mom was an Alzheimer's patient. She received, as an Alzheimer's patient, you're to kind of receive a peaceful environment. You can last longer. And instead, she received a nightmare experience, which was documented by physicians and her death certificate. A number of times, my wife would call the facility ahead of time to remind them she had a doctor's appointment and would say, please make sure she's clean, ready, as they would deliver her to the doctors and we would meet them there. Multiple times she was covered in feces and urine during that visit. We met with the management of the facility and cordially worked with them, and we were promised many times that they would fix and correct. Unfortunately, to no avail. They wouldn't follow the doctor's safety rules for the equipment or for food. One of the last visits, the doctor verified feces in her hair and soiled all over the place. It was smelled so bad the doctor had to leave the door open. My wife went to the care home to stand there to demand that they watch. She watched while they clean her, just to show that they knew how to clean her. And as they begin to remove her clothes, the horrendous fact was discovered as they removed her top, the severe bruising that was severe enough it made the state worker cry. And from down on the right-hand side across her breast and down was multiple bruises. During this time, Farmington, and it appears that many homes do not feel the responsibility to follow the rules to call into the state. They're supposed to report when there's fall or harm that's come to the clients. They never called any of those in. (clears throat) We went to the management after rushing her back to the doctors. That's where she ordered her out of the facility. And we went back to the facility to the management and said, I believe we're all in trouble here. They quickly pulled us into the office and assured us that they would immediately start redocumenting the books and that we would be covered and we would be CYA'd. Very casually, just like you and I brush our teeth. The Alzheimer's and dementia patients like my mom and dad have a disease that speeds up and shortens their life when they're under distress. The problem is that in the current system, and the state number of the state workers see the same problem. As I was called in the middle of my confusion and frustration, and I was explaining, James, do you really understand what's happening? And I said, no, you know, explain it to me. They said, well, look, if we pull up into the parking lot and we verify any of these allegations and sustain any of them, the maximum fine in the state of Oregon is $300. James, they probably won't even take the time to rebuttal any of the claims. They will just write the check and they move on. They don't have enough incentive to actually change the policies to give a better care. They write the check and move on. I remember, like yesterday, the chill running up my back when I discovered that, because I just didn't understand. Yesterday, the top attorney called me in our area and said that they're using the word epidemic in Southern Oregon. We narrowed down the list just in the last 24 months, over 12 facilities have three or more substantiated allegations. It appears in conclusion that, and my recommendation is that the fines be simply moved to match the income in the homes to about $10,000 per occurrence. But if this happens to an Alzheimer's or dementia patient, it's recommended that the fine be tripled. Only then will you see certain policies and procedures begin to change. It is a human rights issue that I don't think we've seen in a decade that we're all heading to. So I encourage everybody to help raise the fines and the accountability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for what you went through.
Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Blaston.
To speak in one of these.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, and also the other members of this committee for the invitation to speak today, and also thanks to my representative McCowan and also you for backing this bill. And there were some other people on that list, too, but I don't have it in front of me. So here's my new picture.
Name. Oh, can you say your name for the record, too, please?
Oh, I completely am anonymous. No. My name is Thomas Blastic, and I live in North Bend, Oregon. And today I am here as a family member. I do not have a political action committee supporting my efforts. I am not being paid nor being reimbursed for my expenses. I'm not here on an hourly wage. My mother-in-law was Dot Wright. She's right here. My wife, Kathy, and I provided 24/7 care for Dot in our home for 2 years prior to admission into Baycrest Memory Care in Coos Bay. She resided there for 26 months. Dot died peacefully in our home January 15th, 2016. Last year, we were privileged to provide testimony supporting House Bill 4083 to this committee. Since then, I see there's some new members, some new faces, and so I was asked by Representative McCowan to give an abbreviated version of my testimony, and it is abbreviated, I promise you. So, the abbreviated version. The December 2016 Oregon Healthcare Association website informing members of the defeat of House Bill 4083, I will paraphrase this, stated, this bill was brought forth on behalf of a dissatisfied family member regarding care. This is factual. Personally, I felt that was very disingenuous. Well, I am the dissatisfied family member. Baycrest Memory Care had substantially failed four consecutive state surveys in less than a year. DHS issued a cease admissions order as well as a notice of non-renewal of license. During this time, substantiated abuse cases by Adult Protective Services increased 100% during this time that they were being surveyed. At one point, the number, total number had reached 33, looking back retrospectively for 2 years. This information is available on the Ombudsman website. There, out of these, six of these substantiated cases related to the poor quality given to DOT. During an active survey process, a residential care coordinator, a key staff position responsible for training of staff, falsified training records to appear that it was complete. She stated the directive came from the top. This was eventually substantiated more than a year later by a licensing investigator. During this time, there was also excessive and frequent staff turnover at all levels. Four different administrators alone. Staff turnovers of this proportion create uncertainty, lack of trust, incontinuity of care for residents and families. We consistently brought our concerns to whoever the administrator was at the time. We contacted the local DHS office on a regular basis, informing investigators of the ongoing poor quality of care. There was frequent communication with the ombudsman, licensing officials, Salem DHS, beginning with, at the time, Ms. Kelly Seal, then Mr. Hathaway, then Mr. Saki. Also, as Representative McCowan said, was in contact with her frequently. I also contacted the Coos Bay Police in Oregon. I also contacted the Oregon Consumer Protection Agency, the Oregon Division of Medicaid Fraud, the Oregon Department of Justice, and Governor Brown. At one point, I called the FBI, but they were a little annoyed with me because they didn't have the time, because that was when the occupation was happening over in the other part of Oregon. So I apologize for calling.
Mr. Vlasic, if you can wrap it up and then...
Well, I will, and I need to finish this. Yeah. And I need to do this. The last to occur was substantiated sexual abuse cases. Five women residents, ages 82 through 92, who were all friends of DOT, were involved. And according to the police report, the actual possible number of women was 14. I am including the 39-page police report with redactions of names of residents to this committee for public record. The owners of the facility, Radiant Senior Living, were issued a $12,500 fine by DHS in October 2016. Radiant Senior Living is contesting the fine. An administrative hearing is scheduled mid-July 2017. Radiant Senior Living is entitled to due process, but this is 10 months ago. Talk about being dissatisfied? Yeah. There was also ample opportunity for a few dirty words to be expressed. Now, keep in mind, this has been an abbreviated version of poor quality of care. Recently, CMS stated, on any given day in this country, 90% of long-term care facilities are out of compliance. 17 years ago, it was 75%. This is a huge problem. A few comments about House Bill 3359.
Could you save those for Olis? Because we do need to save time for other people on this bill, and we've got another bill after. If you could just put those in Olis, that would be great.
You know, with all due respect, with all due respect, Chair Geyer, Kenny Geyer, I drove up here. I'm here now.
I know.
And if we wouldn't have these interruptions, I would already have this page done and this page done, and then I'm done.
We just want to make sure that we have time. There's a lot of other people signed up for this, and then we have another witness that I hadn't heard about. So, but why don't you give one more sentence and then submit the rest for OLIS? Because we also want to get to what the ideas are in the bill.
Well, that's what I have here. Okay. There's much talk about key quality metrics. Here are some of the key quality principles from current literature about this. Improving quality of care is grounded in the belief that often the most informed voices on the care team are those of the resident and family. Ultimately, they alone can confirm whether, one, a plan of care was explained thoroughly, two, the information provided was fully understood, three, the questions and fears were appropriately addressed, four, care was tailored to their specific needs, five, they felt safe, six, systems worked efficiently and effectively, seven, each was treated as a person, a whole person. I do not believe that any family member or resident was at the table for House Bill 33 as part of a stakeholder. And just quickly in closing,
Mr.
today, this is one paragraph. Today I am convinced that even a bill like House Bill 4083, if it was reintroduced and passed, would not be enough. What really needs to happen is that resident care facilities need to come out of memory care facilities need to come out of the residential care facility designation and move to the nursing care facility designation because of the high acuity in nursing needs.
Okay.
High acuity includes
higher needs. Thank you, Mr. Vlasic. We need to move on. Okay.
Thank you for allowing me to go beyond. I appreciate that.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here. My name is Larry Runyon. I wasn't planning on doing a testimony. It just came about this morning. My situation is a more current situation, so please bear with me.
And if you could try to limit this, please, because we
yes,
have
ma'am.
A lot of other people.
My father, my name is Larry Runyon. I manage and run a traffic control company, and providing safety is the purpose of my life function to public motorists, pedestrians, construction workers, municipalities, providing safety and providing training for risk of injury, death, and so forth. My father became disabled in 2009, and through that he was admitted into a rehab facility where the rehab facility, he was completely bedridden. I took off work for months every day to get him back walking. From that, he was diagnosed to needing assisted living from the rehab and DHS. My father was a California resident for many years. I relocated him because he had multiple strokes and was in a hospital and had no family in California, and brought him to Oregon. I became power of attorney in 2009 because upon bringing my father here, I had to switch everything over from California benefits to Oregon. Had no knowledge or understanding how to even do that process. I became his power of attorney. I will speed this up. My father had multiple strokes. He had congestive heart failure. He had COPD. He had a left lung surgery with an upper lobe removal. He had diabetes. He had two brain surgeries from aneurysms, one on each side of his brain. He had short-term memory loss. He had dementia. Multiple things why he needed assisted living.
At what facility?
Brookdale of Eagle Point. That facility is currently on a lockdown from the state on accepting patients. I received photos on the 15th. The 15th of January. They were very disturbing. Very horrific. I went to the facility, as I hear from these two men, and I stated, my father needs a nurse. My father needs medical care. I need someone to come see my father. The facility, the regional director, instead of saying, okay, we'll get someone there because I'm asking for medical help, she says, we're here to inform you that your father is behind on rent and has been given a 30-day eviction. What do you mean? My father has a payee from the state that pays his bill. How can my father be behind when he has a payee that manages his money due to his dementia? Well, let me check. Still no medical assistance getting to my father as I requested it in a facility to provide care. She gets on the phone. Long story short, after speaking with the office manager, because she's a regional that oversees several states, Fort Brookdale, who is a large facility, I'll say as big as a galaxy, they're large, gets on the phone to the office manager, and come to find out, she comes back in, and it's being a recorded conversation, for documented, that I'm sorry, your father's not behind. He's never been behind. All payments were made. The problem's on our end. We received payments. They got deposited. They got cashed. We didn't enter it in accounts receivable. But
what was the condition?
Mr. Runyon?
Yes, ma'am.
So we need to move on to, so we can actually hear about what the bill does.
Okay. Well, I'll just speed it forward then.
The condition.
I invite you to submit it to testimony, to OLIS, but we really need to move
on. Okay, I'll just speed it forward if you give me two minutes.
Can you just take 30 seconds and wrap up your story?
If you'll give me at least 1 minute, I will bring you through. My dad was taken to the doctor on the 18th ER. He was dropped off and abandoned. The people didn't even check him into the hospital, didn't stay with him. He's a dementia patient. He doesn't know why he's there. I get there 30 minutes later. The people are pulling out, handing the MARS report out the window, saying he's inside, not checked in, left alone, dementia patient. Report was filed with APS and Eagle Point Police. My dad, I did an emergency evacuation after reporting it. Took him to my home. On the 23rd of January, I went into APS because I had still not been contacted and stated inside DHS's office, I need to speak with someone. I have not been contacted. Well, sir, fill out a form. We'll contact you. No, ma'am. I'm not leaving. I need to speak with somebody. I had physical evidence. I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving until someone comes out and physically speaks with me. Make a long story short, APS substantiated multiple counts of neglect of care, failure to provide care in multiple ways. Medications. Oxygen removal. The facility removed my dad's oxygen in August and returned it without a discontinue order.
So I really feel for your story. I think if you could submit it for testimony, it's there for public record. We need to get to where we can hear what the bill tries to do to try to address these
situations. You bet. I'll just wrap it up with 15 seconds. Substantiation cases were turned in and substantiated by APS on multiple counts for Brookdale. I submitted a rebuttal letter stating that I want other things investigated that I submitted by emails, requesting it in writing. Please look at all the emails I sent. I feel there's several other counts of negligence and substantiation for abuse that's been committed. My father was...
Mr. Runyon.
Yes, ma'am.
We need to stop.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your story. I'm very sorry. This is what this bill is trying to address.
Did he submit the emails?
And please submit the emails and your story for the record. Here
we'll do.
We'll leave it open until
I just feel that House Bill
tomorrow.
3359 is absolutely necessary in changing the laws.
Thank
the
you very much. Okay, so next we have... Fred Steele. Fred, can you just come up and do a 1 minute and try to help us catch back up and submit something for the record? Because I know you prepared more than this.
Okay. Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, I'm Fred Steele. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. And I want to thank Mr. Beard, Mr. Blastic, and Mr. Runyon for their stories. Those are the stories that our volunteers of our program hear daily, weekly, in care facilities. And so it's important to hear those stories. And that's what the trigger has been in the last year for the conversation and the leadership by Chair Kinnegar, Representative McEwen. Extraordinary leadership by both of them, Speaker Kotek and her office, and Taylor and her office, to get us where we're at. To summarize where we're at from our perspective of advocating for residents of care facilities, and with House Bill 3359, of our top 10 complaints we have, and I'm trying to be quick, so I'm not going to get into those, this bill addresses, goes right at the heart of at least five or six of those. These are issues that our volunteers, over almost 200 volunteers around the state, advocating for individuals in care facilities of what they're addressing, medication administration, staffing levels, professionalizing the administrators of these care facilities, well over 500 buildings, each one with their own administrator that needs to be professionalized. This bill takes leaps and bounds towards improving quality of care and quality of life for the over 44,000 Oregonians living in care facilities. So just want to thank you. I'll stop there. I had a lot more prepared, but we'll stop with that.
And so, submit it for OLIS. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Sorry
thank
to cut you so short. Okay, so can we have Tracy Morgan, Linda Kirschbaum, Dr. Mauro Hernandez? Right. Go ahead.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Morgan, and I am the Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter and Co-Chair of the Purple Ribbon Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to be here today in support of House Bill 3359. As you know, Alzheimer's is a progressive and fatal brain disease that will affect an estimated 5.5 million Americans. It is the sixth leading cause of death in our nation, as well as here in Oregon. Just as startling as the demographics around Alzheimer's is the economic impact it has on our nation and our state. Findings from this year's Alzheimer's Facts and Figures show that the total annual payments for caring for those with Alzheimer's and other dementias have surpassed $250 billion, $259 billion. According to the report, average per-person Medicaid costs for Alzheimer's and other dementias are 23 times higher than average per-person payments for seniors without these conditions. In Oregon, the Medicaid cost of caring for people with Alzheimer's in 2017 will be $222 million. By 2025, this cost will increase by nearly 40%. Let me be clear, abuse and neglect of any kind is deplorable. In response to the concerns about the quality of care in memory care communities raised over the last year and the desire to create the gold standard, the Alzheimer's Association and the Oregon Healthcare Association joined together to convene the Purple Ribbon Commission. Our goal was to bring together an independent entity of commissioners compromised of aging and dementia experts in Oregon that would continue to inform this discussion. In addition to memory care, which represents only about 10% of people affected by this disease, we wanted to look across all care settings, including and not forgetting the majority of people with dementia that live in their home. The Alzheimer's Association is pleased that some recommendations from this are still included in the House Bill 3359. In closing, I'd like to read a letter from one of our advocates, a couple statements that she made, and I will include it so you have the full letter. About 3 years ago, my wonderful husband and partner, this is Kathy Couch, which some of you have met, was diagnosed with younger onset Alzheimer's when he was 56. Because of the nature of this disease, he is no longer able to work in his field as a carpenter. He was forced to retire early on disability, and our world and expectations have been turned upside down. I find myself living in a near constant spiral of fear, loss, sadness, worry, irritation, anger, and guilt. Without becoming involved with the Alzheimer's Association, I would be lost. Some of my biggest worries are the money we are going to need to provide care for Mike as he progresses. That said, I honestly don't know how we will even begin to afford care. We aren't wealthy, we aren't poor, we're just middle class. I feel like we are the forgotten ones. It doesn't have to be that way. Kathy is an amazing advocate for her husband, Mike. Just as the Purple Ribbon Commission sought to do, and as we fight for every day at the Alzheimer's Association, we all need to be part of changing the trajectory of this disease. We all need to do more for families across all settings to connect them with resources early on in the disease. I want to mention a recommendation from the Purple Ribbon Report regarding family and consumer supports and programs. The recommendations from the Commission are to create and fund a health promotion campaign addressing diagnosis of dementia services and supports, and second, to promote a one-stop information support center that provides disease and caregiving information and connects people to the community. Organizations like the Alzheimer's Association are working hard to provide these types of programs to Oregonians in both cities and rural areas. We cannot do this alone. We need significantly more funding to reach the 63,000 Oregonians affected today and the 84,000 coming. Although I recognize that this recommendation is not being included in the final version of House Bill 3359, I will look forward to continuing the discussion around this recommendation with all of you in 2018 so that Kathy and Mike and so many of their other families facing this will not be the forgotten ones. Again, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here today. Linda Kirschbaum, the co-chair of the Purple Ribbon Commission, will share more information on recommendations of the Purple Ribbon Commission.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Kirschbaum, Senior Vice President of Quality Services for the Oregon Healthcare Association, and as Tracy said, co-chair of the Purple Ribbon Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3359. For over six decades, Oregon Healthcare has been committed to improving the lives of older and disabled Oregonians by educating long-term care professionals, caregivers, and advocating for quality long-term care public policy and initiatives. For over three decades, Oregon has been a pioneer in providing long-term care services and supports in memory care. Our data shows that each day, 83,000 caregivers provide long-term care services and supports to over 63,000 persons in our state in all of those settings. With this many people serving and being served, the potential for challenges does exist. But let me be extremely clear. Events related to abuse and substandard care are never, ever acceptable. And it is heartbreaking to hear Mr. Beard and Mr. Blastic and Mr. Runyon's experiences. Again, not acceptable. But not every memory care experience is negative, as we've heard today. Many consumers do have family experiences that are positive, my own family included. It was comforting to know that my uncle, my father, my grandmother all had skillful caregivers who provided compassionate, person-centered care and shepherded each one of those persons through their end-of-life journey. Although compliance information denotes that most communities provide quality care to our seniors and that they rely on that, there is always room for improvement. The words and the stories are powerful. But to truly address the concerns around dementia care, the Purple Ribbon Commission moved beyond the words to actions and solutions via information. The commission developed a set of recommendations, which you all should either have or will receive a copy of the full Purple Ribbon Commission report, which outlines in great detail those recommendations. The recommendations included how to reduce poor outcomes and move the quality needle forward. The recommendations from the Purple Ribbon Commission in House Bill 3359 include supporting caregivers through evidence-informed training, promoting and using a web-based acuity staffing tool to inform staffing patterns to assure that resident needs are met, developing a set of quality measures and tools to track performance measures to publicly report those. Those metrics include, and I think address many of the concerns that have been already addressed, consumer satisfaction. Our conversation would be very different today if we actually had information from the consumers, the families, the residents on their experiences. It would really focus our efforts into the future and how to continue to improve. The other metrics include staff turnover, so tracking how stable is the staff, what is the turnover rate, again, being able to target resources and education towards those folks. And antipsychotic use and staff training are the other metrics, plus the bill sets up a council that will revise and inform those quality metrics as needed and as supports and services change. The addition is, in addition to the vast legal authority that DHS has to address poor performers, the bill also addresses and the recommendations from the commission support enhanced oversight for poor performers by directing the state to increase survey frequency for those poor performers. Some of the recommendations will be time-consuming, challenge norms, and create expense to providers, but we support these recommendations because they are the right thing to do to advance dementia care in Oregon. These solutions from subject matter experts are objective, actionable, and will position Oregon as a national leader in quality dementia services. Our vision is a world without dementia, but until that time, these are actions that we think will promote quality care for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today in support of House Bill 3359. For the record, my name is Mauro Hernandez, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Concepts in Community Living and a member of the Purple Ribbon Commission. CCL has been operating and helping develop supportive housing options for older adults since the late 80s. We own or operate 12 licensed assisted living facilities here in Oregon, largely in rural markets, and these tend to serve a relatively high proportion of Medicaid residents and, of course, like others, a high proportion of individuals with Alzheimer's disease or related dementias. I'm also a researcher whose past work has focused on long-term care, financing, and regulatory policies, both in Oregon and the U.S., with a particular interest in access to home and community-based care and quality improvement. My remarks today are going to focus on two of the recommendation areas from the Purple Ribbon Commission's work and the rationale for them, caregiver training and competency, as well as quality measures and tools development. First, the Commission recognizes that good training is an essential ingredient to drive quality care. Providers recognize a shared challenge of recruiting and retaining caregivers that come with the right combination of personal qualities, skills, and knowledge to provide competent, high-quality, person-centered dementia care. Our rural communities, such as Hines, Myrtle Creek, Sutherland, and Baker City, often don't have a large enough labor pool to draw from, and local training resources are really limited. As a result, there's a real need for expanding evidence-informed training resources and tools that providers can utilize for developing the knowledge and skills of our caregivers to provide a high-quality care. The Commission's work, we also got to review the research literature on training requirements and outcomes across the country. One of the things we learned was that there's really no magic number for minimum training hours that need to be provided. So when it comes to training and quality, we concluded that a better approach would be to focus on adopting standards for a memory care curriculum and outcomes measurement, as well as focusing on competency evaluation and verification. After all, being able to recall information from a 10, 20, or 40-hour training program means really little if the caregiver really isn't able to apply what they've been taught. Second, the Commission also agreed that quality indicators should provide a more holistic or comprehensive view of quality dementia care. At this time, our regulatory system, and this isn't limited to Oregon, is in licensed community-based care settings, is largely focused on procedural compliance and then individual problems that either we report as providers or others report. And policymaking happens with very little evidence or data related to outcomes or performance. So, and considering the really large and growing body of research that exists about quality in assisted living and the extent to which quality metrics are already being used and have been being used in other settings, hospitals, nursing homes, hospice, to drive performance, it's really well past time to adopt more quality, more comprehensive quality performance metrics. You've heard a mention of the consumer's voice. I mean, and this is probably not the best example, but when we go to pick a restaurant, we don't go onto the state side and look at their health rating. We look at what other consumers say. And we're really not, I mean, a lot of providers are using collecting data on consumer family and employee satisfaction, but that data is not really being used at an aggregate level by the state or is accessible to consumers. So we think that that's a real opportunity for us to focus on. Focusing on quality metrics could be a game changer for our profession and for Oregon. They would allow us to track performance-based outcomes and examine the relationship between these indicators and the more conventional ones in order to drive improvement through evidence-based changes in both industry practice and regulatory policies. As a provider and as a researcher, I know that these indicators would require a lot of resources and staff time. At the same time, I also believe that the value of adopting quality metrics in terms of having a more evidence-based approach to quality would be a worthwhile investment for providers, for policymakers, and for consumers. So thank you for the opportunity and entertain questions or next comments.
Any questions for the committee? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the need and some of the issues that we face with some of our facilities. How does this bill impact people who do it right?
There are the bill and my colleagues from DHS as well as Phil Bentley from OHCA will address some of that. But we did want to create incentives. So for the communities who do track and trend and report their metrics, that will be public measure that will really create competition, so to speak. So your poor performers will even be highlighted more, but there will be that information out there for the good performers. So right now, all we have is kind of the negative metrics. All you can find online is complaint data or survey data. So this will really kind of balance the scorecard, so to speak. So if my consumer satisfaction score is 95%, but Morrow's is 99%, I know I have some work to do. But hopefully that will be available to consumers to see how a good provider is doing and that they can make more informed decisions. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Wanted to look at any unintended consequences.
Some of the details obviously have to be worked out through the Quality Metrics Council, which is outlined in the bill.
Okay. I am going to close the public hearings on House Bill 3273 and 3359 with my apologies to Phil Bentley and Ashley Cunningham Carson and Kendall Mason. The three of you are closer to this building and can come back. And so we'll just have you open up when we have the work session and use that as the opportunity to explain. I'm very sorry. It's very, very hard to cut off people who come here from far away with their stories. And I'm sorry if I did not handle that as elegantly or as compassionately or as effectively as I wish I could have. Very hard to handle, but I think that it's better to not make you guys do something really quickly. And we'll have the dash one at that point, and you'll really be able to walk us through it. So thank you, everyone, for your testimony.
Thank you.
We need to at least give some time to House Bill. I'm going to open House Bill 2903. We may not be able to get through all this, and we can carry it over to tonight for those of you, like Representative Olson, whose bill it is will reserve his testimony for tonight. But Senator Gelser, and could you please read the summary?
Yeah, I'll try to do
it. Is it a short? And who else? Janet and Kim. So Janet and Kim, would you all like to?
No, go ahead.
He's going to wait till tonight.
Okay.
So you can just kind of, if you kind of give an idea of what the dash threes are.
I can do that now.
Would you like to, instead of having the, since there's a dash three, it's pretty much a gut and stuff, why don't you describe the bill, Senator Gelser?
All right, thank you. A little bit of a migraine today. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis and Albany. So Representative Olson and I are from the same neck of the woods. And also Kim for a long time, actually, from the same cul-de-sac. So I'm here today to speak about House Bill 2903 in support of the Dash 3 amendments, which really are a gut and stuff of House Bill 2903. It does three things. One, it creates an off-ramp. There are four really bad things that if they happen in a child-caring agency, the law says that a license must be revoked or suspended. And those four really bad things are a child dies as the result of a substantiated allegation of abuse, a child is known to be being physically or sexually abused by the agency and the agency does not take action to stop that abuse and fails to make the mandatory report, the agency interferes with or refuses to allow an investigation, or the agency refuses to, not forgets to, but refuses to provide required financial documentation. What this bill does is it creates an off-ramp that if the problems have been ameliorated, there is a process in order to rescind that letter of revocation. For 3 years, that would be done by the director in consultation with the Oregon Youth Authority and the Oregon Health Authority. If it is a medically-based facility, after 3 years, the director would decide how to do that. There is public process that is involved in that, and it says that that decision can be made based solely on the considerations of safety of the kids in the program. So it can't be based on the capacity of the system, for instance. The second thing that it does is that it removes some language that was very upsetting to people in the industry, which is alleged perpetrator when an abuse investigation is taking place. And the third thing that it does is it asks the department to come back and talk to us about what the benefits and drawbacks would be of something that would be called a deemed status. So if an organization was a member of an accredited organization, would there be a way that we could loosen some of the oversight and any duplicative oversight of these agencies? With the Dash 3 amendment, I would be very happy to support House Bill 2903. I'm really grateful to Representative Olson. He and I have spent a lot of time together talking about this, and also Dr. Richardson and Clyde Psyche at the department have also been in many of those meetings, and Kim Scott and Laura Smith. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Kim Scott, CEO of Trillium Family Services, and we're Oregon's largest provider of behavioral health services for youth and their families, including the state hospital level of care. We're in support of the Dash 3 amendments and want to just really recognize Representative Olson and Senator Gelzer for coming together on this critical issue and working on agreements that we think balance the safety needs of youth and their families, but I think also is supportive of a provider and environment that is really trying to do their best in providing those services. So we're in support of this, and I want to thank both Andy and Sarah for their work on this.
Thank you.
Janet Ahrens, Executive Director for the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. A lot of thanks to Vice Chair Olson for a tremendous amount of work on 2903. Very, very much appreciated, and also appreciated the opportunity to work with DHS and their candor in responding to some of our ideas. That was very helpful. I just want to leave a few numbers with you. I sent you some testimony last night. There's some more going around today. 23, that's the number of BRS contracts that have been turned back over the last 4 years. These are contracts that were turned back without licensing or investigative issues. It's important to understand that the board of directors, for the most part, makes these decisions. They're community leaders, business leaders, advocates, parents, and other professionals. So it's an important perspective that they offer in those decisions. Half, which is a number of those that were returned since Give Us This Day happened. There has been a flood of negative media, including social media, that has painted a community of providers as prone to child abuse without short leashes and new laws. So that's been very, very challenging for folks and has had an impact on our ability to be able to recruit quality staff and to keep the foster parent homes full of appropriate foster parents. And to that point, child welfare's most recent number on representing the loss of capacity in our therapeutic foster care system at 50%. 64 is the estimated number of lost subacute and psychiatric residential beds in the last year or so. 30% is the reimbursement gap for provider rates that three state agencies, advocates, CCOs, youth, and providers all agree on. And 28 is the number of members in the alliance who are subject to new laws and who unanimously agree that there are pathways to child safety that regulations alone cannot achieve. And that's the key point of 2903, and the bill and the work is to bring some fresh strategies to be part of the toolbox for how we're going to ensure child safety.
Okay. Did you want to? Are there other people that want to testify who can't come back tonight? Because it seems like we're kind of close, actually. Would you like to hold it over for tonight?
Yeah, I think I'll wait till tonight.
Okay. All right. With that, I'm going to suspend, is that the correct word, so that we can hold it over?
Carry over.
I'm going to carry over House Bill 2903, public hearing until tonight, and the committee's adjourned. Public hearing until tonight, and the committee's adjourned.